With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, why the tamper-evident packaging rules of the SOE could be a challenge, and how a grant that supports varroa mite management will also support specialty crops. But our top story today, a new ruling from the U.S. government changes fertilizer rates. David Geiger has this report.
Fertilizer companies are concerned about a near 20% reduction in countervailing duty orders. The U.S. Commerce Department upended a 2020 ruling on Moroccan phosphate. Ben Pratt with Mosaic Company says initial rates were 20%, now down to 2%.
But the duties remain in place, and there will be another round of consideration from the Commerce Department next year. And in fact, Mosaic is appealing the ruling that just came out. So there's a lot of process still to play out.
The duties were put in place because Morocco subsidizes fertilizers in ways the U.S. does not. Pratt says companies there have cheaper access to mineral mines and raw materials.
Those practices haven't changed. And so the possibility of renewed unfair trade practices exist.
The Commerce Department's reason for the change is clear in the documents, according to Pratt. They looked at the expenses faced by their Moroccan competitor, OCP.
So it wasn't a change in market conditions or the underlying causes for the duties. It was a change just in calculation.
The phosphate market is global, Pratt says. Right now, prices are benchmarked to major ag markets.
The long-term impact could be significant if unfair trade practices resume. The short-term impact should be pretty minor for American farmers and farmers in the rest of the world. Right now, the global phosphate market is tight. The supply is tight. And so every ton of phosphate that my company and every other company makes is finding a home. And so in a condition like that, where prices will stay relatively high.
In the long term, Pratt thinks U.S. farmers want a reliable, high-quality source of American-produced fertilizer available.
And if unfair trade practices from highly subsidized competitors to American companies are allowed to continue over the long term, that threatens the American industry, and then that would threaten American supply of fertilizer.
I'm David Geiger.
Will a change in the Mexican administration bring a change in Mexico's policy on imports of genetically modified corn? Gary Crawford looks into it.
At the just-concluded United Nations COP28 climate conference, there were about 200 nations represented, and while the time did not allow the conference to issue a final message or text for the entire meeting, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says 152 nations did sign onto a special declaration.
A declaration that outlines the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that we can produce the food necessary to meet the nutrition needs of the world now and in the future.
And do it in a sustainable way.
It lays out a series of commitments and directions that I think are very, very consistent with what the United States farmers and ranchers have been engaged in.
Namely, participating at record levels in market-based voluntary conservation programs. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Ag lawmakers pressed for their farm bill priorities at a Members Day House hearing last week. Lower crop insurance premiums, pesticide labeling reforms, and support for cover cropping were among the lawmakers' farm bill asks. Chicago area Representative Sean Kasten says his bipartisan cover bill would build on a successful pandemic cover crop program.
By incentivizing the planting of cover crops on a voluntary basis, by providing farmers with $5 per acre of crop insurance discounts for every acre that they plant into cover crops. In 2018, Iowa implemented a very similar program, was hugely successful, oversubsidized. My own state copied it in Illinois. It since has been copied in Indiana and Wisconsin.
He pointed out to a study this year that found more cover cropping led to lower crop insurance losses, as much as $40 million in savings for every 1% boost in cover crops. That is by improving soil health and trapping carbon in the soil. Minnesota's Michelle Fischbach called for direct support for crop insurance. She said to get away from inefficient, deficit-ridden, ad hoc disaster aid.
Crop insurance has proven to be a bedrock risk management tool. And while I appreciate the fiscal constraints on this committee, I firmly believe an opportunity exists to build on the program's success by making higher coverage levels more affordable to producers across the country.
Separately, Texas's Chip Roy joined Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley in calling on House and Senate leaders to include in the Farm Bill SNAP and CCC spending reforms and controls on foreign ownership of U.S. farmland. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. In today's National Spotlight, the UN's COP28 climate conference resulted in a milestone declaration signed by more than 150 nations. Gary Crawford reports.
The current administration in Mexico continues to stick by its plan to ban imports of U.S. genetically modified corn starting January 1st of 2024. That is the policy of the current Mexican administration. However,
on September 30th, that administration leaves office.
Which could change things, maybe. According to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, he told reporters Sunday there's no scientifically based reason for Mexico to ban GM corn, and that trade ought to be based on science. And on that score,
the two candidates for president, the leading candidate is a scientist. My hope and belief is that as a result of a new administration, they will take a look at the science, take a look at the fact that they are reliant on the U.S. for yellow corn, and that the relationship with the U.S. is important.
He said he made that point again when he met with his Mexican counterpart during the just-concluded U.N. climate conference in Dubai. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Grain shipments are taking a backseat to other goods as shipping slowdowns continue through the Panama Canal. Shipping through the century-old engineering marvel is being squeezed by drought and low water levels. Marianne Labacher, the ocean freight lead at CHS, gave an update on the situation during a webinar last week.
What is happening is because of the lack of water at the Gatun Lake, they have to limit the passage of the ships. All the time one ship passes through the canal, basically there is a displacement of water and there is some water which is thrown away, if I can say. So it's a bit strange that you have a lack of water between two oceans, but the regulation is based on fresh water. And you have a lack of fresh water availability at the Gatun Lake. And so for that, they limited the passage. And while our Panamax ships and grain used to go via the Neo-Panama, which is you have two different canals at the Panama Canal. You have the Neo-Panama, which has 13 meters, and you have the old Panama Canal draft, which is 12.04. So to give priority to other type of ship, container ship mainly, and gas carrier and oil, they just closed the Neo-Panama for dry bulk vessels.
Many companies, particularly those moving fuels from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Asia, have been willing to pay extra to ensure that their ships get through.
I think now it's about 18 days to 20 days congestion, but that's not the worst. We saw that already. But now you need to have to book a slot and you need to auction the slots. And the price of the slots are going up to $1.5 million for dry bulk vessels, and you still wait for 12 or 13 days. So they don't see any, talking to the agents we have at the Panama Canal, they don't see any improvement of the situation by Q2 next year. So now we have a bit of a shift in the market on the dry bulk, especially all the ships are going via Suez or via even the Cape of Good Hope, because you cannot foresee what is going to happen in Q1 next year in terms of how bad the congestion will be and how bad the situation will get.
Gatun Lake, which forms a key stretch of the canal system and provides fresh water for its locks, saw little rain this year as El Nino triggered a severe drought. The bottleneck is expected to only worsen in the coming months as Panama enters its annual dry season, which typically begins in December and lasts until April or May. That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, U.S. pork exports posted another strong performance in October, led by record large shipments to Mexico and broad-based growth elsewhere, according to data released by USDA and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation. October beef exports remained well below last year's large totals, but improved from September, led by a stronger demand in Mexico and Taiwan. October pork exports totaled 245,345 metric tons, up 3% year-over-year and the largest since June, valued at $688.2 million, down 2% from a year ago. Shipments to our leading pork market, Mexico, reached new highs for both volume and value, while exports to other Central American countries were among the largest on record. Exports also increased year-over-year to the Dominican Republic, South Korea, and Oceania. For the first 10 months of 2023, pork exports increased 9% from a year ago to 2.38 million metric tons, with a value up 6% to $6.66 billion. While pork exports have been hot, beef exports are looking for growth. Beef exports totaled 104,446 metric tons in October, down 17% from a year ago, but 6% above the low volume posted in September. Export value was $836 million, down 11% year-over-year, but 5% higher than September. October exports posted significant year-over-year increases in Mexico, Central America, including a record volume to Costa Rica, Taiwan, Europe, and Africa, but continued to trend lower to Japan, South Korea, and China. January to October exports for U.S. beef reached 1.08 million metric tons, down 13% from the record pace of 2022, while value fell 17% to $8.32 billion. On the beef side, economic headwinds in our largest Asian market continue to weigh on demand as consumers trade down to lower-priced proteins, said USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom. The recovery in Asia's food service sector has been limited, but we remain hopeful that it will accelerate in 2024. Recent efforts to jumpstart economic activity in these countries and address weakened currencies could also improve the business climate. U.S. lamb exports also experienced cooling in October. While achieving growth in Central America, October exports of U.S. lamb trended lower overall, falling 47% from a year ago in volume and 28% in value. Through the first 10 months of the year, lamb exports fell 11% to 2,054 metric tons, while value declined 12% to $10.7 million. Exports increased in Central America, Japan, and the Middle East, but these results were offset by lower shipments to the Caribbean, Mexico, and Canada. In other livestock news, USDA's weekly National Fed Cattle Comprehensive Report, published on December 5th, showed all steers and heifers, dressed and live, trading lower than the previous week, but higher year-to-date. Looking at dairy-bred-fed cattle, dressed cattle trended lower from the previous week, while live cattle traded higher. Looking at live dairy-influenced fed cattle, they traded higher than a year ago. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
More operations having to get certified under the Strengthening Organic Enforcement Rule is raising a few concerns. CEO and owner of Fruit World, Bianca Caprilian, said that buyers and handlers complying with another set of rules is absolutely doable, but there is one particular issue with tamper-evident packaging.
Retailers are kind of pushing back, saying that they don't necessarily want to get certified organic, and that they're kind of pushing on the growers to create tamper-evident packaging so that it's kind of the loophole in the rule. And what I've been saying is that if a retailer at their distribution center, if they're going to open those boxes and open those packages and QC the product and they're not organic certified, it doesn't matter if it's tamper evident or not, that product now that they've looked at is no longer certified organic.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's allocated funding to 21 projects, including one led by the Varroacide Resistance and Testing Team through the Honeybee Health Coalition. The funding's part of an initiative to enhance the competitiveness of U.S. specialty crops. The VRTT project focuses on addressing varroa mite challenges faced by North American beekeepers, aiming to develop safe and effective varroacides to fill research gaps. The project's goals include reevaluating current varroa management tools, creating new chemical controls to overcome resistance, and integrating approaches into comprehensive varroa management plans. By collaborating with beekeepers, the team seeks to reduce honeybee colony losses and enhance colony strength for effective crop pollination. The initiative aligns with the broader objective of supporting sustainable practices within the industry to ensure competitiveness both domestically and globally. Producers have support available to help improve habitats for pollinators. Environmental Engagement Manager at Bayer Crop Science, Tim Fredericks, described their Bayer for Biodiversity initiative.
So Bayer for Biodiversity is a program where we partner with conservation groups, educators, academics, and really people that are involved in adding more diverse habitat to the agricultural landscape. So one that we'll mention right away is Project APSM. They have a program called Seeds for Bees. It's a free cover crop seed program. And what it does is they're looking to really add blooming forage for bees that are brought in to pollinate the crops early in the season. So not only helps with bee health, native pollinators, and managed pollinators on those lands, but also has a multitude of benefits, building soil organic matter and infiltration of water, and the benefits to adding those cover crops early in the season are really multiplicative.
The concept of regenerative agriculture shares a lot in common with organic production. VP of Environmental Science and Resources at Braga Fresh, Eric Morgan, said that he sees regenerative farming as being something like Organic Plus.
I think that there's a number of growers that are probably certified organic and are actually growing regeneratively without any level of certification or even knowing it. Growers that have a ton of biodiversity in the farm, growers that use a ton of compost, growers that have found ways to reduce their tillage, growers that implement livestock rotations through that they may not even pursuing, you know, a regenerative certification. But as far as like it being organic plus, yeah, I do think that, you know, a lot of the organic produce that's being grown is largely being grown with a conventional mindset, a conventional produce mindset with organic inputs. And for me, that's why I think of regenerative being organic plus.
The California Table Grape Commission's offering three types of scholarships to students interested in ag. Two types of scholarships are offered for field workers and their families. The first is for graduating seniors who wish to begin their higher education journey at a community college. The award, known as the Bridge Scholarship, will help with the transition to a four-year university or college with a $14,500 award. The second is a $25,000 four-year scholarship for graduating seniors who wish to attend a four-year university or college. The third category of scholarship is a $25,000 agricultural scholarship available to students in the Coachella or San Joaquin Valleys who will attend a four-year university and are interested in building a career in the table grape industry. Three of each type of scholarships is available, and the deadline to apply is February 9th. More information is available at grapesfromcalifornia.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. The U.S. cotton crop is likely to be smaller than was expected just a month ago. Gary Crawford has details.
Another downward adjustment in USDA's estimates for U.S. cotton yield and production.
A pretty modest adjustment, but it is a downward adjustment on what was already a really low yield, lowest since 2003.
Wow, USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer, and yes, USDA on Friday downgrading its previous estimate of average cotton yields by 18 pounds an acre, taking it down by 185 pounds from last year. That would put the crop at 12.8 million bales, 12% below 2022, and to add to the problems cotton growers are already having.
We're definitely moving in the wrong direction for global demand for U.S. cotton producers.
USDA forecasting a drop in U.S. cotton exports, but also another drop in the use of cotton by U.S.
Since about 2000, we've seen a very sharp decline year after year on our domestic mill industry as that milling has gone overseas, and here we find ourselves now below 2 million bales.
Lowest since the late 1880s.
And the USDA is forecasting a bigger orange crop than last season. Gary Crawford continues the coverage.
This season's national production of oranges could end up being just under 2.75 million tons, which would be 10% higher than last year. On the surface, that seems to be good news, and it is. However,
the only thing that's saving this year when it comes to things like drop and fruit size and is that last year was so bad.
USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says that certainly applies to the Florida crop.
And the only reason that you would come up with a number that says for in the case for Florida, for some of these orange crops, that it looks better than last year is because last year's drop was so horrendous because of the two hurricanes.
This year's been fairly calm weather-wise. USDA's forecasting Florida orange production 923,000 tons, 30% higher than last season. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. A partnership between the USDA and a popular soft drink maker continues to restore forests and watersheds. Gary Crawford joins us once again with this edition of Agriculture USA.
Here's a TV commercial stab from the past, 1969.
It's a real thing. Coke is the way it should be. Coca-Cola.
We are playing this old Coca-Cola commercial not to sell the product. We of the Agriculture Department not allowed to do that. But just to set the stage a little bit for a really neat story that you're about to hear, we hope, on this edition of Agriculture USA, I'm Gary Crawford. Well, while we have the chance, let's go with one more classic TV ad, this one from 1971.
I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company.
So what has the Coca-Cola Company got to do with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and its Forest Service? Well, it turns out that the Ag Department has been working with the Coca-Cola Company for the last 10 years to do a lot of environmental-type work in our national forests, wetlands, and watersheds, work to improve the quality of the water coming out of those watersheds and going into homes and businesses. Coca-Cola and the Ag Department forged a 5-year agreement back in 2013 to share the costs of those projects. The agreement worked so well it was renewed in 2018 for another 5 years, and you guessed it, a few days ago in Washington, officials of the Coca-Cola Company and USDA got together to renew it again. And the Ag Department's Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources, Merrill Harrell, says under the agreement,
we're able to co-invest in watershed projects in a number of places around the country to be able to accomplish water treatments that make a difference to watershed health, to aquatic habitat, and to quality of water for communities downstream.
But why are the folks at the Coca-Cola Company interested in sharing costs of those projects, costs that can run into the millions of dollars? We asked Kirsten Witt with Coke's environmental policy team. She told us,
it is part of our purpose and our mission to make a difference and ensure that the communities that we serve are healthy and sustainable. And water is a critical component of that. And so for us, it's also the main ingredient in our beverage. But human life is dependent on water. Much of the resources in this country and elsewhere around the world are under a great deal of stress. And we recognize that we need to do as much as we can to help protect this precious resource. And so much of the work that we're doing is focused on protecting and also engaging the local community to make sure that everyone understands sort of the importance of conserving water, protecting our watersheds. So collectively, we hope we can do more together. In partnership.
So how exactly does that partnership work? For that, we went over to Kurt Ritter, who helps run Coca-Cola's North American Sustainability Function.
We jointly evaluate different projects together and determine the viability of those projects, and then we will determine cost and how we can share in that. So generally, we share a 50-50, if you wish, unless there's other potential partners that join certain projects.
Well, can you give us an idea of what kind of projects that you're talking about?
Recent project we completed together in Gunnison, Colorado, where a lot of the runoff from the water from the mountains doesn't properly enter into the wetlands, and it runs off in the streams without being preserved. So by restoring some of the wetland habitat through the creation of beaver dams and other man-made initiatives, you can actually conserve more water up in the wetlands that then can continuously benefit the surrounding habitat that depends on that water.
And the Deputy Agriculture Secretary, Social Torres Small, told the signing ceremony for the new agreement that the partnership with Coke over the last 10 years has produced lots of good results.
So far, the partnership has resulted in 900 acres of land restored, which achieved over 14 miles of stream restoration with more than 1,000 stream restoration structures installed and 17 miles of river, as well as 62 acres of upstream lake reconnected.
She says this unique partnership has allowed the Agriculture Department to do over $5 million worth of environmental work using only $2.5 million of taxpayer dollars. And with that, She and Kurt Ritter signed the agreement, extending the partnership for 5 more years. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford for the USDA.
Looking at weather and commodities now, how is drought coverage for winter wheat growing areas according to the first U.S. Drought Monitor this season? Rod Bain tells us.
Crops in drought is usually a quiet category on the U.S. Drought Monitor in the winter months. One exception, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey, winter wheat now heading into dormancy.
The overall number for winter wheat in drought as of December 5th is 37%. Now, the good news is, even with still more than one-third drought coverage on that winter wheat crop, that is the lowest number we have seen at any time in the last year.
Almost one-half less winter wheat acreage in drought from this time last year.
And we did see a higher number during planting. We saw a peak in the autumn of 49% winter wheat in drought. So the numbers have crept downward. That is good news, and that explains why we're seeing our best overall U.S. winter wheat conditions since the 2019 planting season.
This coming with pockets of drought in all the nation's major winter wheat growing areas. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's interview segment.
I'm Vernon Peterson. I'm the founder of Abundant Harvest Organics. We grow stone fruit in Kingsburg, California, peaches, plums, nectarines, apricots, a little bit of citrus. We grow chickens. We pack fruit for about 100 of our neighbors. We do all of that organically in our own farming, and all of our stone fruit growers are also regeneratively certified. Our farm is certified at the gold level for regenerative. We're also EFI certified, as well as organic, ROC, Global Gap, what all, you know?
So pretty robust certification there. And here at the Organic Grower Summit, you were part of a panel session that was just kind of talking about regenerative and its relationship to organic. And number one, a pretty point-blank question that you were asked, what's the difference between regenerative and organic? And you had a pretty poignant response.
No, the question was, can you be regenerative and not be organic? That was what I pointedly responded to, and my response was no, that would be impossible. There's no way you're building soil organic matter. There's no way you're stimulating biology in the soil in a chemical system. Regenerative is something that must be built on top of an organic system. Regenerative has to be built within a biological system, not within a chemical system.
And that was one of the kind of points of conversation throughout the panel was, being at a certain time where regenerative seems to be, they're working on a definition for it.
Sure.
How is the organic sector maybe positioned to be involved in those conversations, and what are some of the points that really might need to be highlighted there?
Yeah, so we know the truth, and we're living that truth, but certainly there's other words that have come along, sustainable, you know, what we call weasel words, greenwashing words, so sustainable, regenerative. What's some other stuff? It's not sprayed, that kind of junk that you hear at a farmer's market, you know. But consumers know we've got a problem. Consumers know there's health issues. And they have a sneaking hunch that a big part of those health issues are due to the food they're eating. Organic pulls the toxin out of the production cycle, but it doesn't build soil necessarily. It doesn't necessarily take care of the farm workers. You cannot have a holistic system and exclude the farm workers from that system. If you have animals, there has to be some animal welfare in that if you're going to have a holistic system. So that's my point. You can't sink one end of a ship. We can't make ownership float or barely get by. But on the other hand, consumers first need to be assured that we're not just pulling the toxin out of the system, we are indeed building soil, we are indeed taking care of the people. And so a third-party certification takes care of that and gets rid of the BS that I'm regenerative because I planted a cover crop into no-till GMO UN32 fertilized corn. Okay, there's no way you are being truthful when you say that.
And that was one of the conversations that was had was having those different certifying bodies, what that means. And one thing that you had brought up is how you take care of the labor force around it. And I wanted to get into a little bit more of that in terms of, you noted one of the certifications that you have that takes in that element and how important that is in the overall conversation with regenerative and how you treat your folks.
Yeah, so we have two certifications that speak to the social. The foundation is one called EFI, the Equitable Food Initiative. EFI is a from the ground up employee driven, how do we work together to build a better organization, a better company. So to do that, we had a 40-hour training. Bilingual training. We included 20 of our representative people from the field, the packing shed, cold storage, QC from sales, and lots of positive things came from that. I don't know how long you want me to talk about that, but we're never going to build the best company top down. People on a ladder, people on the line see things that ownership is never going to see. And to have their input, first off, to have a structure for them to give input, something beyond a suggestion box, but monthly meetings. What are we doing? What can we do better? So we have that in each department, and then we have quarterly meetings that bring everybody together to talk about the whole of the company. So that's EFI. And then our regenerative accepts the EFI certification and then builds on it as far as employees. Well, regenerative organic certification, we call ROC, primarily is talking about building soil, regenerative, but we've also got to regenerate the farm community, the farm workers. So they have a living wage component. So that's a second way we're addressing the social standpoint, if that answers your question.
Thank you, Brian. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. The Farm Bill deadline was extended to the fall of 2024, but that doesn't mean there's a lot of time for more discussion. Former Senator Heidi Heitkamp talked about that while speaking at an ag forum last week.
Because if you think about what the House has to do between now and the CR, the continuing resolution extension, there isn't a lot of time. And then by the time you get into real dialogue, what happens is you're up against election. People go home, people are, and it's just not an atmosphere that's conducive to bipartisan compromise.
Competing interests for limited funding and ideological differences on topics like nutrition programs have made compromise difficult during final negotiations, but Heitkamp says there is common ground on the idea of do no harm, that is to programs like crop insurance, the commodity title, disaster relief, or energy.
And by that I mean do no harm in the sense of do not upset or take benefits away in crop insurance, in commodity, in disaster relief, in energy. I mean, so it's like everybody recognizes the baseline that needs to be established for the crop insurance program. There's efforts to enhance that program, but they can't do that if they don't find extra money. And the IRA is a looming, pot at the end of the rainbow that they want to draw on, but it is politically unpalatable for the Democratic Party.
Heitkamp says the new wrinkle is the integration of the Inflation Reduction Act program expenditures.
Right now, the IRA is a temporary funding piece for important conservation programs like EQIP. Right, that are overprescribed, and so if you take the IRA funding at its maximum amount and put that into the farm bill, you now have built the base for future farm bills, right? And so the Republicans do not want to build the conservation base that high. And they would like to take some of the money that they say is not expended in the IRA and use that to basically expand other programs within the farm bill.
She says that's a non-starter for the Democratic leaders that she's talked with. In April 2019, with Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Heitkamp launched One Country Project, an organization aimed at helping Democrats reconnect with rural voters. In January of 2023, Heitkamp became the director of the University of Chicago Institute of Politics. Did you know you could take leftover waste from watermelons and turn it into plastics? CJ Miller has more.
That's what a newly formed company based out of Indiana called AgroRenew is planning to do.
So we're taking watermelon waste and reducing it down into a micron dust and blending it with some other bio sources to form a resin polymer that can then be used to make various types of plastics.
And that's Brian Southern, who co-founded AgroRenew with his wife, Katie.
The uniqueness about this is that this plastic is 100% biodegradable. Everything gets decomposed and goes back into the soil, including replacing nutrients in the soil. So very unique from that perspective.
Brian talks about how the idea was created to convert watermelon waste into bioplastics.
We were talking with various farmers about the amount of food waste they have every year and the crops that they don't sell or they don't pass their quality. And the number is just staggering. It's, you know, approximately 100 million pounds a year. And we're like, there's got to be something better we can do with that. And so we started to research, my wife, Katie, who's a food scientist, and myself, who is a processing engineer, looking at what are some other ways that we could utilize this bio source.
And that's when Brian and Katie decided to pool together their knowledge and expertise of food science and plastics to develop the new product.
We kind of started to experiment and was able to determine that, yes, we could use portions of the chemical properties of a watermelon to create a resin polymer that is 100% biodegradable.
Construction plans are already in the works for AgroRenew's brand new $83 million facility that's being built near Vincennes, Indiana.
We should have most of that completed by the end of this year with a target of sometime in March breaking ground. And then they're estimating about a 10-month build out for the plant.
The new facility is set to be up and running by 2026. I'm CJ Miller.
A new USDA agricultural trade update for the 2023 calendar year is showing export value decline for exports as well as imports. Here's Gary Crawford.
Last year, we saw U.S. agricultural export and import values growing, with imports growing faster than exports. But so far in the first 10 months of this calendar year,
now we're seeing decreases in both.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says so far ag exports are running 11% below a year ago. Imports are down by 2%. Import values had been growing quite a lot, as you remember, because of inflation and higher unit prices. But Kenner says
that inflation has started to ease and volumes are continuing to stay pretty consistent. And so we're starting to see some of that decrease in import value overall, as those prices start to come down a little bit.
So the overall level of U.S. ag trade is declining, and for exports, soybean sales are down 10%, wheat 29%, corn by 33%, cotton by 35%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That is today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.